Hi, welcome to episode number 5 of the Startup Grind Dublin podcast, brought to you by Startup Grind Dublin. I'm David Scanlon, your host for this episode, where in true Startup Grind fashion, we continue to share and celebrate the daily grind of founders, entrepreneurs, and innovators everywhere. In this episode, we dive into the world of gaming in an interview with Richard Barnwell, founder and CEO of Digit Gaming, the largest independent game development studio in Ireland, and the driving force behind the smash hit Kings of the Realm. We've also decided to experiment slightly with the show format, so this episode will feature the first half of the interview, which we originally recorded in December 2015 at Google's EMEA headquarters here in Dublin. All going well, we'll feature the second half of the show early next week. In this first half of the interview, Richard and I discuss his early goal of becoming a millionaire before turning 30, surviving in the hit-driven world of video gaming, the crucial lessons he learned during a brief foray into the world of B2B enterprise SaaS, and the pains of winding down a company. I'll catch you again on the far side. Until then, sit back and enjoy the show. So Richard Barnwell is the CEO, founder of Digit Game Studios. He's been involved for many, many years, much longer than his youthful appearance would tell you. You know, early 20s, he was with a company called Jagex in the UK, in a senior operational role, moved on to a B2B company called Secure Virtual, then became the CEO of Jolt Online Gaming, which was founded here in Dublin by one of our previous speakers, Dylan Collins, and then in 2012 founded Digit. I briefly forgot what the name of your company was. Digit Game Studios, which is Ireland's largest video game studio. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome him. So if you wouldn't mind, everyone up on their feet, a big round of applause for Richard Barnwell. You on?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're away.
Sounds good for everybody?
Yeah.
Yep. Sweet.
It's a low chance.
They're a little bit low, yeah, but you're okay.
We're tall guys. We'll be surviving. Welcome. Thanks so much for coming along.
Cheers.
How are you?
Very well.
Good.
Bit nervous, what are you going to throw at me today? But that should be okay.
It's okay. It's okay. It would be easy. We called it a roast, but it's not a roast. I'm not going to be
I'm sure the guys in the audience have seen these, that it's, I should expect a roast.
Yeah. What's the best thing that's happened to you this week? Just to get you into the mood for answering
nice, easy
questions. Best thing this week?
Best thing that happened this week is that I got to play the new build of our new game.
Oh, come on, you can't
say that. I've got to say that.
You can't say that, because you're not allowed to tell anybody what the game is.
No, I'm not, actually, right. No, that's true. That's very true. God, blimey.
Other than that,
actually,
other than
being the best thing that happened this week is that we actually hired a senior server developer this morning.
Okay.
And that's one of the hardest roles we have to fill.
Okay.
So, as someone who spends most of their life trying to fill vacancies, and anyone else who owns a business is probably in that same situation, that is probably the best thing we've actually done this morning.
Okay, cool. So you're not from around here?
Well, no, not originally. I've been here for about 5 years now.
Okay, but so over and back for a bit of that as well.
Yeah, so moved over full-time in 2010 when I was running Jolt,
yeah.
And then moved back to the UK in early 2012.
Okay.
And I was going back and forth for a couple of years. So over here during the week and back in the UK at the weekends. And then moved over fully about 14 months ago.
Okay.
So now we're here fully.
Let's go all the way back and talk about early days, Richard. Richard growing up, and did you grow up in an entrepreneurial family? You know, was it something that was talked about an awful lot?
No, not at all. So my dad was he was in the RAF and then was in construction. So I grew up in a builder's house, I suppose. And my mum was a hairdresser.
Okay.
So in a pretty, I would say, fairly standard kind of family, really. There was definitely no entrepreneurship. It was very much work hard to get things done.
Okay.
So I think the effort came out of the household was purely if you want something, you work for it.
Okay.
So yeah, but entrepreneurship was definitely never spoken about. Even that word wasn't introduced.
And then sort of like on a personal level, then were there sort of like, you know, business leaders or entrepreneurs in the sort of the public sphere that you would have looked at and said, well, that's an interesting option for me in the future?
Yeah, I would say actually in my childhood that was never a thing. So I think the key thing that I got from childhood was I was sent out to work from kind of first paper round of 12 and okay. was working for like a small electronics shop of like 14 or okay. whatever. So my parents were very much get out there and start earning money. I mean, they were very big into education as well. So, I went through the normal education system and did these jobs part time.
Okay.
But I definitely wasn't looking specifically at business as a whole, business leaders. It wasn't something that really I'd got interest in until I started really working. It was maybe a late developer from that point of view.
Okay.
Kind of, wasn't massively interested till about kind of 1920, and then I realised actually if I want the wealth that I was looking for, then this is the route I have to start taking. And so then I transitioned very quickly.
Huh. So that's, is that the vision then? Was that the sort of the goal that drove you?
At the time,
I want to be at a certain level of wealth. And
yeah, I think most people are honest when they're in that age, like 19, 20, it's all about, I'll be a millionaire when I'm 30.
Yeah.
I need fast cars, I need to have a private jet, or whatever the rubbish is that you leave is going to make you happy at that age. That was actually the original goal. It was as I've got older and kind of family and kids, I realized actually that's actually not what's interesting. And that kind of has changed, and I've changed quite a lot, I think, going on that journey. But initially, yeah, it was very much, so if you want significant wealth, then you can't do that by having a traditional career because you're limited.
Yeah.
And so that then kind of progressed that thinking process. Okay.
So talk a little bit about where you are at the moment with Digit. Sort of give paint a picture of what the company looks like today.
Okay, so Digit is, as of today, it's 3.5 years old. It has one live title, one live game that's been commercially successful for us. We have another one in development that launches in summer. We have another one we start developing in January. We have 50 people today with 20 vacancies. We're growing pretty aggressively, I think is probably the best way to put it. We've managed to find success in a market that's very, very tough to survive in. It's very hit driven. Game studios is all hit driven. So if you're lucky, you're away. And if you're unlucky, unfortunately, that's the end. The games company's making it past 3 years is pretty rare. So really pleased with actually how that's gone. And I'm pretty comfortable saying Digit's my particular trajectory now that everyone gets very positive about, very excited about. And that's enabling us to hire some amazing people. And I think like many tech businesses, it's all people orientated. Mm. It's such a creative industry. We don't have a particular product to sell. It's already all kind of what our guys can create. And so for us, attracting talent becomes our biggest requirement. And the last 6 months, we've brought world leaders into the company. And
okay.
We don't make so much about it. We need to say a bit more. But I think for us, that's kind of like keeps us going. That's kind of keeps the company going motivated. Okay. And that allows us to do some big things.
Okay. So I think before we dive into some of the aspects of what you're talking about there in terms of the industry that you're working in, it's probably worth unpacking the games industry a little bit, right? Because I think everybody is... Did you break the sound?
Hopefully not, do
it. Okay. Somebody else break the sound?
I think someone else is.
The games industry is so broad. People say, I like video games, and everyone has played them at some point along the way. Can you maybe dive into kind of say, like, where you are in the industry? You kind of talked about titles and, that it's a hit-driven game. Like, what do those things mean to you?
Sure. So the chances are most people have played a game.
Yeah.
Most people haven't even realized they've played a game. Whether it be a board game like Scrabble, whether it be Candy Crush Saga on your phone, or Farmville was a massive hit on Facebook. But when people say gaming, I think the general rule of thumb, people start thinking of, they must be shooting people in the head. It has to be really hardcore. It's only something that 16-year-olds play. And there's elements of that are true. PlayStation 4, Xbox One, that's a massive industry, and a lot of people think that's just gaming.
Yeah.
But actually, the gaming industry itself is absolutely huge, and mobile has been one of the biggest growth areas. So we actually focus specifically on online devices. So we focus on iPhones, Android phones, tablets, anything with touchscreen, and then also on browsers and PC as well. So we try and we kind of spread the net fairly wide from that point of view. And then we focus on strategy games, so games that take quite a high level of skill to play.
Okay.
Also fairly immersive and require a significant amount of time to get good at.
Okay, but also to develop.
Unfortunately, the flip side of that is they're quite hard to build. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the average dev time for us, we're a bit fast now because we built the technology behind the scenes, but generally 3 years would be kind of an average build time.
For one game.
For the first game was 3 years. For every game from now on, because we have the engine that's already in place, we can generally do that in around 18 months.
Wow.
And there's a significant upfront cost to obviously bring that to life.
Okay. So then talk a little bit then about the actual, I suppose, the content of the game, right? Because the game is so much more than an engine and, manically, tapping on a screen, right? There's story, there's character. Do you own that intellectual property? Is it typical that you would own that yourself, or do people kind of buy the rights to Frozen and then make the Frozen mobile game? Or
both of those are valid.
I'm not fishing for the name of the game.
You're not going to get that, but you can try. So our first game, we owned everything. So it's not Frozen. Yeah, I can say that. So our first game, we owned everything, including the storyline, the brand, and whatever else. We managed to get a book deal with Penguins. We have a trilogy of books around the brand and on all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas the next game we're working on is actually based on a movie brand, an IP. And that's basically down to commercial reasons. So the scary reality is right now to pay for an install on a mobile device is between $10 to $15 in our segment. So if you want to kind of scale that up into numbers, and you know, I won't go into the details, but you need 5 to 10 million installs nowadays to kind of reach in the top 10. So if you want to try and do the maths on that, not many companies can on day one write a check for $25 million. That could be lost because you don't know yet if your game works.
Yeah.
So that's where the brands become really powerful, and it's why there's a massive resurgence right now in IP-based gaming.
Okay.
Is because those brands bring with them installs, and that has a real dollar value.
Okay.
So that's kind of where there's a mixture.
So I mean, from you know, looking at it from an industry-wide perspective, for an indie game developer to start out with, you know, a game they think that the story is wonderful. I'm thinking about you, like, you know, 2012, you went to a bunch of people, presumably, you know, people that trusted you, and said, I've got an idea for a game and a story, let's do this, and we'll just get some, you know, 10, 15 million to buy a load of downloads. How does, a founder starting off go to an investor and say, gamble on this? Because like you said, it's hit-based, right? Because it could be the biggest flop of a game.
So we generally don't start by saying, gamble on this.
Okay, that's yeah. So while we're on that theme, right, you know, top three things not to say to an investor are...
Yeah, hit-driven, gamble on this. Yeah. So I think there's a real big problem for indie developers to actually take that route. And that's why things like Steam, etc. have become so successful.
Sorry, what's Steam?
Very good point.
So Steam is?
So Steam is an online distribution platform specifically targeted for small games development companies. And it's mainly on PC, so it's very niche. And if you're into PC gaming, you would have seen it. If you're not, you won't.
Okay.
When Digi was looking for investment, so we took a slightly different angle. So firstly, the team we bought had been in games for a while. We'd all worked on billion-dollar plus franchises, and that allowed us some kind of credibility to try and reduce that hit-driven risk. So that's the first point. The second one is that we took a particular angle with technology that allowed us to acquire a lot of assets and be slightly smarter by accelerating the company. And the third one is that we decided to go down a business model route, a publisher-based business model route, where we weren't upfronting the capital requirement to launch the product ourselves. So from an investor's perspective, we were not saying, give us $1 million and we're going to use it all for marketing spend and hope it works.
Mm-hmm.
We were saying, give us $1 million, we're going to create IP, and then this other company is going to be sacrificing their money for a revenue share.
Yeah.
So we shifted the business model to enable kind of VC investment.
Okay.
And it worked out well for us.
Okay.
And also there's a couple of lunatics that backed us. One of them's in the room. I don't know who he is. I saw him earlier.
I'll call him out. There he is. Hi, David.
Yeah. So David's one of the crazy ones that thought this was a good idea.
No.
But yeah, games generally are very tough to get VC money into.
Okay.
And there's very few companies that can take that route in the games industry.
So now's a good time to step back then into your sort of your career path, right? So what, you know, let's talk about what informed you to stay in the games industry, which is a crazy thing to be in, right? Because I always think, like, you know, tech entrepreneurship is insane anyway, right? So you'd want to be slightly delusional to start it at all. And then to do something that is so based on, you know, what's happening culturally around the world and, you know, all those crazy influences, it seems crazy. It's a crazy lot. So let's talk about your own background. You went into Jagex.
Yep.
And that's kind of the start of your career and your experience there. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this was the moment where I came back from university and sat down with my dad. So, Dad, I've got 3 job offers on the table. And one was from a big a mining company. Another one was for a big entertainment company. And then there's this five-man team up in Cambridge that are just like doing some stuff to do with games, and paid about a third of the salary of the other two, etc. So I went with that one naturally. My dad was really proud.
Yeah.
He thought it was a great use of the university money he spent.
Yeah. How was that getting you to the millionaire by 30? How did you figure that one out?
Yeah, that didn't. I did it really because of the people.
Okay.
And I started realizing at that point actually I gravitated towards people that had this passion for making something and. Turns out I like making games, and so I joined these guys, and I learned with these very, very intelligent guys, very, very quickly that actually hard work and passion can create something very special. And luckily, they were also very smart. So.
And when you say you enjoyed making games, were you actually, you know, were you a developer? Were you engineering the games?
No, when a company's that small, you're kind of everything.
You're everything.
So,
okay.
So I did not write a single line of code
okay.
for that game. Which thank God, because that would have been a disaster. Although my background theoretically is engineering, comp sci, I was never a very good programmer, so I'm glad I'm not doing it, and they should be glad too. Instead, I ended up doing things such as helping design the management tools or running the game from behind the scenes, or community management, customer support, billing, HR, game design, all that stuff.
So this is a talk about JAGX, right? Because it quickly stopped being a four-man team and you developed a pretty big title, and your role shifted very quickly because of that.
Absolutely, yeah. So JAGX went from being pretty much nothing to a 500-man team in 3 years. And in that period of time, my team went from being me to 300 people. Across all technology teams, so that's game engine, DevOps, server management, infrastructure, and this was before AWS existed.
Yeah.
You know, you're doing the stuff yourself. Yeah. And then customer support and community management. And what people don't realize is the scary part of gaming. We have to manage fraud's a massive deal, child grooming, all this kind of stuff that happens inside these scary chat rooms has to be managed by the games companies because we become liable for them.
Yeah. And like you say, a lot of that stuff is sort of like the industry has moved on, and a lot of those tools are readily available. There's industry bodies and all those kinds of things. But like with JAGX, you guys were, that was brand new.
Brand new, yeah. So copper compliance was rolled out while it was at JAGX, PCI DSS compliance. These are various big projects that no one really wants to have to do, but they appeared. And then also I end up kind of doing things with the art team and then the QA team and game design teams and all sorts of bits and bobs. But that product became hugely successful. To this day, it's still the world's largest free-to-play game, a Guinness World Record for the largest free-to-play game.
This is RuneScape.
This is RuneScape, yeah. Okay. So 200 million people play that game. And then that's actually the official number. I think unofficially it's like 300, if you include all the Chinese bots and all the other stuff that goes with it. So that was a really interesting journey.
And I'm fascinated because you came out of a comp science degree and went into a small gaming company, and then in 3 years you're managing 200 people.
Yeah, that's all right. Yep.
And these are, as you say, like, you know, they're top quality, and you know, they're highly professional people, yep. Very, very skilled at, you know, very, very specific tasks. What in your background prepared you for that, or did anything?
Was it? Yeah, I think that's a sink or swim moment. Yeah. I think I've always had a fairly high baseline of self-confidence, so I think that helped in some ways. But there were definitely moments there of doubt, significant doubt. When you're performance managing people who have got 20 years on you inside kind of their skill set field, and you're at kind of a very young age trying to kind of guide that in the right direction, there was definitely moments of, hang on, is this the right thing to be doing? But the guys that run that business, the founders, put complete faith, and I think that's really what drove it through, is by having that faith from the people who you respected so much, it kind of forced you to perform at a particular level. And then it was, for me at that point, I got my confidence through reading. So it became a daily habit for me to start digesting as much information as possible from those who had gone through these experiences before.
Okay.
Built business. And that's where I started understanding really how these companies have been built.
Yeah.
And so at that age, that was actually how I got the confidence to do what I needed to do.
Okay. And I mean, the rest of the team, the founders of JAGX, had they been through a similar process before, or were they equally as green as you?
We were all very green.
So their faith was founded on nothing at all.
Nothing
at all,
yeah.
Richard is available and seems keen.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably an element of that, yeah. I mean, I think luck is a massive part of my career path, yeah. So the main founder, a guy called Constant Tedder. I mean, he was a bit older, he was about kind of 15 years on us, and he'd actually had a small business beforehand, but no one did
this.
He was like
20, right, at that stage.
Yeah, I was five. Yeah, I mean, he was a good guy, and he had a bit of experience from a smaller company, but nothing like this scale.
Okay.
But yeah, there was four of us, and I think our average age was about 25. I mean, so but I think it's one of those situations where the company's growing so fast that you either have to have faith in who's there and just hold on and go for the ride and try and pull off the best you possibly can do, or it collapses. So we just held on and we did everything we possibly thought was the right thing to do. And then later on realized how many mistakes we made all the way through. Like, I mean, we made so many mistakes, it was crazy. And we had to fix so much stuff later on. And when we brought in professional management.
Tell me about a mistake. What did you personally get wrong?
My biggest mistake, and the one that's going to doesn't haunt me, but it's definitely performance management of people.
Okay.
So
this is when the people that were directly reporting to you, your division, say you were using performance management. Do you want to just
exactly, yeah. So for those who manage people, I'm sure this rings a bell with you anyway, but so in that structure I had a number of direct reports, and then some of those had more direct reports, and then went all the way down. But as a very inexperienced manager managing that number of people with so much to do, I became very straight talking, is probably the best way to put it. HR was a bit of a pain, it kind of got in the way. There were people who just were not delivering what needed to be done, and we had deadlines that could not be missed. And so I started shifting towards a default tactic of being pretty aggressive about solving problems. And you know, that doesn't build a great culture. And it actually took one of my direct reports, who was a very experienced guy, to actually sit down and have a really frank conversation to kind of shock me, realizing that I'd kind of formed this particular personality type that wasn't really natural to me, because I'm actually quite nice. it was kind of wasn't natural to me, but it was the way that I'd kind of learned to deal with these situations. Okay. And for me, you know, it was a massive mistake, because I think I alienated quite a lot of people in that process.
So the way that you were behaving and I suppose the approach that you were taking, was that the norm for the rest of the company, or that was the Richard approach and everyone I don't want to have to work with this guy?
Yeah, it was the Richard approach, because I really at that point was only kind of me worrying about those teams.
Yeah.
There was another guy there, a guy called Daniel, who to this day I respect very highly and still ask for advice now and again, who was much more personable. You know, and he was someone who actually I'd lean on at this point, so I need to shift the way I'm managing these people.
Okay.
And then, of course, we brought an HR team, and then proper HR directors came in, and then the whole thing went away, and they said, okay, this is how you do it, by the way. Here's the process you should be following. Oh, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
You should give them, like, 30 days notice. Oh, okay, makes sense.
Or you'll be sued, right? Yeah.
And, you know, and what happened, of course, is once I started shifting, very quickly the team started performing better.
Okay.
And then the power of the culture became so important to me. And now I like to think that Digit, which is my fourth company, I've been doing that kind of running, that we've kind of got that right, where I actually do understand the importance of doing it and treating people very fairly. And
So Jagex, it obviously was a commercially successful company.
Yeah.
Were you on the cap table there? So you were a salaried employee, very senior role, obviously, on the operations side. Okay. Why did you leave?
I think, you know...
Was it a HR conversation that you need to go?
No, that didn't happen. I can say that one. So Jagex reached a particular point of scale where there was a big transition in the management team of that business. So the entire management team ended up leaving, actually.
Okay.
They brought in a new CEO. The founders wanted to kind of transition and do their own thing. They'd been there. They were done, ultimately. Yeah. Everyone was tired. And so with the new management structure coming in, the company's culture changed very, very quickly to a different style and approach. And for me, I mean, maybe naivety, but I felt very good at what I did, but I felt actually I didn't know very much. So I was having conversations with other people in other businesses and realized actually I knew everything there was to know about building an MMO games company.
Mm.
That's pretty niche.
Yeah.
Actually, it wasn't very useful to any other company, really. So as I started to get to know people, and I hired a mentor. Mentor was a really nice guy, been around for a long time, and was running a bank. That actually led me to this transition to B2B. Because I said, actually, you know what, for me to reach my career goals, I can't stay in MMO.
Mm.
This is too niche. I need to go and stretch my legs and go further afield.
So you went from the world's largest MMO, which is cool and sexy, to the most boringly unsexy, terrible company. And you moved from Cambridge to London as well. It's a terrible company, right? Secure Virtual. What does that even mean? It could be virtual and secure, and no one would know the difference.
So,
tell us about
your brand name. There we go. I think... You know, it might sound terrible on the outside, but at the time, I thought it was quite cool.
Okay.
So it was doing cloud hosting environments, which I know sounds really geeky. Oh, yeah, okay. It was doing cloud hosting environments for massive companies. And that, for me, was actually pretty interesting, because I hadn't really seen it. So although I understood the technology behind it, the Jagex environment server structure was pretty impressive.
It's super far away from Jagex and gaming. I mean, did you deliberately say I'm going to go as far away from gaming
pretty
as possible?
Much. Yeah, I literally wanted to shock myself to see if I could sink or swim in a different world. I floated. That's probably the best way to put it. I moved to London, started wearing a suit most days, was on the tube, going to various kind of very big corporate meetings, sales cycles of 12 to 18 months to sell an insurance company their hosting SaaS solution. I mean, that's hard work.
Yeah.
That's hard work. And a very different type of person as well.
Yeah.
You know, kind of, I was used to people who were extremely creative, very dynamic, would just throw their hands in to do something. And suddenly people wanted specs. They actually wanted, like, to build something needed, like, tech specs. When it took like 6 months to write a document or something, I couldn't do it anymore. It kind of reached a particular point where I was done.
And just to cut across, you came in there as CEO, right? So, and it was a very different role for you, so as well. Tell us about that. How did you get involved as CEO?
I think, you know, when you're in a larger company of like say 500 people and you're senior operating, so really you're effectively a CEO inside that business. You have budget responsibility.
Yeah.
You looking after P&Ls. You're expected to understand the management accounts. You're managing, you know, in my case, 300 different people across a commercial product with very significant revenue streams. So it actually was very little transition from that point of view. The real point of difference was actually having a consumer-facing part of the business, an actual sales business. Where previously it was all e-commerce. So that was kind of a bit of a transition. Did that for a couple of years, and then got out.
Then Jolt came up.
I've been in games since. That's right.
So your brief sort of flirtation with the boring suits in London didn't last long.
Yeah, I think that's my wife that forced me to get out of there, actually. I'm quite stubborn, so I wasn't going to give up. And to be fair to that business, I mean, it was very profitable and increased by hundreds of percentage points over those 2 years. Had some very, very big deals closed. And the guy who owns that company, still running that company, is probably still the smartest guy on the planet, with pure intellect capability. But it was not for me. And my personality started changing.
Did you... Your personality started changing when you went to the Secure Virtual?
Yeah, I became really grumpy. Really grumpy.
So you were aggressive in Jagex.
Grumpy. Secure Virtual. Such a nice guy now. I went through the loop. No, so I think what happens, and I don't know if other people are like this, but I get pretty absorbed by what I'm working on.
Sure.
And so my personality starts almost being formed by how immersed I am. So I'm immersed in a world that was suits and sales cycles, and generally what is a pretty tedious work. And it ended up kind of reflecting on the person I was becoming. I was becoming more boring, more grumpy.
When you went to join as CEO, did you set yourself sort of personal targets, you know, for, you know, things I need to learn that are very different from Jagex, you know, and what were they, and did you feel you achieved them?
Elements of that, I mean, the main one I was really trying to learn was how a different business, a completely different business ran from the absolute kind of micro detail. So this business was entirely different from e-commerce business, you know, a B2B sales business where you're dealing with insurance companies and financial institutions and selling them a large commercial infrastructure project that needs to last for 5 years plus. It was an entirely different business. So my goal was literally to understand that business and then make it successful. And that was pretty much the goal.
Okay.
And that goal was achieved.
Yeah.
What I underestimated was actually how important it was to really enjoy what you're doing. So I convinced myself I'd enjoy it because it was a business, but actually what I was working wasn't enjoyable. So
was the bigger goal of a millionaire by 30, you know, kind of hovering over you there when, you know, and you were convincing yourself that maybe I'm not enjoying this, I'm wearing a suit, but you know, this is a better way to get to that goal.
You know, if I look back in hindsight, there probably was an element of that. Although my desire for wealth has started shifting pretty dramatically at that point. You know, in that kind of the Jagex ride started teaching me a little bit more about myself and what I enjoyed doing. And that striving for wealth started kind of dipping. And actually, I found that I got much more enjoyment out of the more simple things in life. So there probably was maybe subconsciously an element of that, yes, if I look back in hindsight. But I'm not so sure.
Okay. You decided that the suits weren't for you. Gaming drew you back in. You were lured back into the sort of the online gaming space.
Yeah, so that's the magnetic personality of Dylan Collins. Yeah.
Yep.
So I was over in London working for this company. I was still involved in some other games companies and mentoring a few people, and was having a fairly good time apart from things being a bit dull. And I started talking to Dylan in the summer, maybe early summer, and what he was up to and changing things. Anyway, 6 months later, just the way the kind of process works, met GameStop and came over. Started working with Dylan at Jolt, and about 3 months after that, Dylan moved on to his next adventure.
Yeah.
And then I took over Jolt and started running that business.
Okay. Do you want to talk a little bit about what Jolt is for people who might be familiar with the Dylan Collins Jolt gaming
story? So Dylan, for those of you who don't know, is kind of an Irish entrepreneur. He's been several businesses. He founded Demaware, I think he did Forest, another one. And one of his businesses he founded in 2007, 2008. Quote me on that. It was a game called Jolt on a games company called Jolt Online, and its job was to create social games for the likes of Facebook that were based on brands. That was kind of his concept. And he made a couple of games during the process, and then sold that business to GameStop. And GameStop are the world's largest video games retailer, so they're like a $13 billion a year outfit. So he sold that business to them, and then they ran as a subsidiary of GameStop.
Okay, and you came in again as a CEO type role into Jolt to replace Dylan.
Ultimately, yes, but originally there was a little bit more. Actually, Dylan would kind of still be slightly involved, kind of chairman level and or whatever else. But he was off to do his next adventure as Dylan does. And at the point, then he stepped out, and then kind of GameStop asked me to kind of take more control, and that's basically what happened. So I ended up spending a lot of time working for GameStop, and then a big chunk of time looking after Jolt.
Okay.
And Jolt was a 50-man team at the time, but I think Dylan was ahead of his time with regards to brands and games. And you know, I think if you look back, he probably would agree he may have signed one or two brands that were slightly tricky to work with. which made the first year a tough challenge.
So will I tell that story? Or do you
you go for it, because you're going to enjoy it.
So he's talking about Playboy. So I was on the sort of the investor side with Jolt at that stage, and when we heard that Playboy was going to be one of the games they were building, there was some alarm bells going on. So.
Yeah, I mean, I must say, when you join a games company and one of your goals is to build a Facebook game, if you think about Facebook, that's played by your kids or your parents and your relatives, based on the Playboy brand. And I couldn't really work out how that was going to pan out, that I'm going to play a Playboy game and then share that with all of my friends and parents. And it was commercially a slightly tricky one to navigate through. But that was one of the fun stories that I'm kind of trying to build through. We did build a Playboy game, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Contractually obliged.
Oh, that must have been very difficult for you, Richard.
It's actually, you know what, that specific game caused me no end of pain. I mean, you can imagine going home to your wife, what are you working on? Oh, a Playboy game.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. My wife's a pretty strong woman, and that didn't go down too well. And then some of her best friends are very strong feminists, so you know, this thing became an absolute nightmare for me. But it was a good fun journey. But unfortunately, Joel, which, you know, it didn't keep up with the times, and it couldn't transition fast enough. As much as we tried to transition it into being ready for mobile, it didn't get there fast enough. And GameStop had a couple of tough years, and one of those tough years, they decided that actually they're going to pull out of all their investment projects, and that was one of them.
Okay.
So Joel closed down in the kind of late 2011, early 2012.
Talk about that relationship with GameStop, because it's interesting. Like, you know, in your career path, you were working with the founders, and then you moved into Secure Virtual, and you were directly working with the founders, the CEO, and then, you know, when you came to Jolt, Dylan had moved on, so maybe the vision of the company wasn't so strong anymore, and you were working, you know, as you said, you were working more with GameStop than you were working almost with Jolt at that stage. What was that relationship like with GameStop?
You know, I think a lot of people ask that question, and I think the assumption everyone makes is.
Gotta ask something.
Over the last while, everyone's always said, oh, you know, what's it like working with GameStop and whatever else? And there's always this assumption that this big American behemoth that must be really hard to work with. And it turns out they were lovely, which is much to my surprise. And I'm sure other people have other experiences, but the guy running Europe for GameStop, a guy called Niall, is an Irish guy, really down to earth. And he's like, look, we've made this investment, we want to make this thing work. You've got this amount of time, what do we need to do? Okay, let's do it. Now, in the end, we didn't get that amount of time, but that's a different story.
I suppose what I'm really curious about is, like, you know, how open were they for you to be bringing your new vision for what Jolt could be, based on, like presumably they hired you, I shouldn't presume, they hired you because of your JAGEC experience?
Yeah, I would say that's a big part of it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's...
So how open were they for you to bring that into Jolt and say, look, this is where I want to take it? You know, you bought the company because of Dylan, maybe, but he's gone, and I want to take it this way. Like, was that part of the relationship good?
You know, what they were trying to do is find a way to get digital commerce working. So they wanted digital products they could try and sell by their retail stores. That was the model.
Okay.
So what they were looking for were product they could then put in front of people in a store and then to monetize. And that is one hell of a challenge. I mean, you're trying to give someone a physical product inside the store for them to go home, go to their PC, log in, enter the code, and then start playing the game and converting. So it was a tough challenge anyway. So that was their goal, their motive. And our job was to build a product that would actually make that happen.
Yeah.
So we kind of had open reign with regards to what we created, but we had to sell it hard.
Yeah.
And especially over in the US, and for those of you who work for American companies, you generally know if you're not in the US, it's pretty hard to get them to see your kind of point of view. Because we're competing for budget against other US investments.
Sure.
Yeah, that was always a bit of a tough challenge. So the view definitely changed. So Dylan moved on. Dylan set a particular kind of vision we wanted to try and achieve. With Dylan moving on, GameStop definitely had a different vision. Those divisions definitely were not aligned. And so it ended up becoming... It became almost like an experiment for GameStop in some ways. But I must say, I couldn't give. They gave a lot of support to make the business successful in that year. But it was just a year, and you know, there's not much you can really do with a team in a year to transition it fast.
Did you feel you were able to learn something from it, or was it always just, as you said, just, you know, a GameStop are driving me to execute on this pathway for their business model, which is, you know, possibly flawed. But did you have a space to learn from what was happening there?
I think you always learn when you're doing a new challenge, and I think that what we learned with Jolt specifically is there were some great guys there, but the team was not built as a games company. I think you learn that with a bit of experience. You know, there were some talented people there, but lots of them didn't have any games experience or any games backgrounds. So when it really became tough, and as there was games to be built, it was too slow. The team itself was too slow. And so that meant there was an awful lot of time I spent actually transitioning the business into a different type of business.
Okay.
Bringing a lot of people in, had to let a few people go. And so we learned how to do that in a good, fast way. Unfortunately, not quite fast enough. And
okay.
we didn't get the products to the scale we need them to be. But I think, you know, unfortunately it closed down. It was actually the point it was starting to be a strong development team. And luckily, most of those people have gone on and they found jobs. A lot of them went to PopCap, which then closed down 6 months later, which is a bit unlucky for those guys. But a lot of them, most of them now have kind of gone on and found their own career paths, which is good.
So the timing of that, that's sort of like late 2011?
Yeah, that's Christmas 2011. Yeah, I remember it well, yeah.
Not a great time to fold a company.
Not a great time, yeah. So it was a slightly stressful Christmas Eve, actually. Yeah. Obviously, we didn't fold the company until the January, but the actual decision was made in the December.
What's that like to go out to a team that you've been coaching and you've been, you know, blood, sweat and tears with for 12 months and to say, look, it's done?
Yeah, I think anyone who's ever been in that situation, I think a lot of people have, it's heart-wrenching. Yeah. You know, letting people go is just not nice. It's just the reality of it. And when you know people, especially when you've hired them or you've relocated them from around the globe and you know their family and their kids and then you've moved them and, you know, 3 months before you'd be saying, look, it's great, we're financially backed by this massive American business, complete stability, you know, it's all guaranteed, let's go make it look great. Yeah, you're looking in great shape. So yeah, that actually isn't the case, and I'm afraid we're closing the business now. To be fair, GameStop did like a really strong kind of exit package for most people, and they looked after people as much as they could do.
Yeah.
But you know, it was pretty tough. Pretty tough. But I think in any of those situations, just honesty is actually what gets you through it. And of course, I'm sure there's some people out there think that I'm an absolute arse because, of course, I closed a company down. But I think most people just really appreciate the honesty. The guys back in this company, it's losing money. They can't afford to lose anymore. So the company's closing down, and this is what it looks like. And generally, everyone was okay.
Hello, and we're back. Thanks for listening right to the end. Isn't Richard lovely? Such a gent. We'll be back with the second half of the interview in episode number 6, so stay tuned for that. A quick reminder about what we do at Startup Grind. We're the world's largest independent entrepreneur community, and we aim to educate, inspire, and connect each and every founder on the planet. We host a series of fireside chats in over 200 cities worldwide, across almost 100 countries, and you should join us. Check out our monthly event series at www.startupgrind.com/Dublin, or you can search for us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Thanks for listening, and keep grinding.